The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning.
We'll start with 4-22-0016, Estate of Lewis versus Dr. Matthew Yeager et al. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Michael Ratzak.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
Ian Barron.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. As I said, my name is Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of Elton Lewis, the plaintiff appellant in this case. He's the administrator of the estate of Tyrone Lewis. As the court, I'm sure, is aware, this is a situation where Tyrone Lewis received medical care by various doctors, one of them being Dr. Matthew Yeager. Dr. Yeager moved for summary judgment, basically on the ground that because he had not actually seen Tyrone Lewis on August 29th when he came to the clinic, he was not legally responsible and thus not a proximate cause of Mr. Lewis's death a few weeks later. The difficulty with that position is that the record is clear that Tyrone Lewis was Dr. Yeager's patient. Dr. Yeager was the attending physician for Tyrone Lewis. That's not been disputed. And if it was, we know that, if the court may recall, Dr. Teal, the resident for Dr. Yeager, the one who actually saw Mr. Lewis, said, "I report to the attending physician." And in this case, she said, "I reported to Dr. Yeager." That makes Dr. Yeager the attending physician, which makes sense because the court may recall that Dr. Teal said that Tyrone Lewis's care was not actually ever transferred to her. She was simply doing the bidding of Dr. Yeager and reporting the symptoms back to Dr. Yeager. I mean, if that was not enough to ensure or set up a situation where Dr. Yeager was responsible for the medical care, I mean, directly responsible for the medical care given to Tyrone Lewis at that time, Dr. Yeager agreed that he had the ultimate responsibility.
Well, can we ask you about that, Mr. Ratzak?
Yes, sir.
Ultimate responsibility sounds like a legal conclusion. It doesn't sound like a factual conclusion. You're not arguing, for instance, that Dr. Yeager is vicariously responsible for the negligence of Dr. Teo, are you?
No, that's not our point, and that never was. That would be I think that's moving into what the defense argued below, that it was a supervisory situation. And we're not arguing that Dr. Yeager did not ask the right questions of Dr. Teo or ignored something that she presented to him or even picked a bad resident, put somebody in charge of something that he or she was not qualified to do.
But your expert doesn't say that Dr. Yeager had to come in and see the patient, right?
No, that's correct.
And really the heart of your claim is that he didn't overrule the resident that he was supervising.
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. The heart of our claim is that Dr. Yeager, when given the facts of the situation, should have ordered, and this is what our experts said, should have done, performed or ordered an endoscopy. It's not so much a question of overruling or disagreeing with the resident. It's just that our experts said that given the symptoms that, and keeping in mind, this Mr. Lewis just didn't walk into the clinic. He'd been seen by Dr. Yeager and Dr. Teo in the hospital. He was intubated there. When he came back for the follow-up care, he had symptoms of shortness of breath, and Dr. Teal said angioedema, which is a swelling of parts of the body. Dr. Gerland's point is that given the history of the patient and given the symptoms being reported by Dr. Teal to Dr. Yeager, Yeager had to do something, and not just over, Yeager had to go ahead and perform an endoscopy. I don't think that's overruling the resident. The resident didn't say not to do an endoscopy. The resident was coming back to Yeager and saying, "This is what I saw." This strikes me as being very close to the hypothetical situation in the, it might be a Darren case where the court said, you know, if a doctor calls up and works with somebody over the phone, and that person makes some reports back to the doctor and the doctor does something, that doctor is still responsible for the care of that patient.
Counsel, may I ask a follow-up question in regards to proximate cause then? The deviation that's identified is the failure to order endoscopy, given the facts supplied to Dr. Yeager by the resident, what does the evidence establish in regards to proximate cause? If an endoscopy had been performed at that time, what would it have shown and what would have been the course of action?
Dr. Gerland's affidavit testified that if an endoscopy had been performed, that would have saved or given a chance to save Mr. Lewis's life. There was no issue in the trial court about cause and fact. The motion for summary judgment did not come in and say that plaintiff did not prove cause and fact here, that if A happened, B would have happened. But I can tell the court that Dr. Gerland did say they should perform an endoscopy, and an endoscopy would have saved his life. And endoscopy is not simply a diagnostic tool, it's a treating tool. And so that's the basic tie-in. And no one in the trial court quarreled with the fact that performing an endoscopy would or would not have or would have saved Tyrone Lewis's life. The only position they took in the trial court was that because Dr. Yeager didn't physically see the patient, he was somehow not responsible for it. And underneath all of this, Dr. Gerland said it was his duty to care for the patient. And that follows from the fact that he's the attending physician. That goes back to the Thiel case, T-H-I-E-L-E case that we cited, where one of the two doctors had seen the patient earlier and then was there when the patient came into the operating or into the emergency room with some problems early on and said, okay, I saw him there, but I didn't examine him. I trusted my partner to take care of it. I left. That doctor was held to have a duty to that patient, to care for that patient. That's all we're saying that this doctor had here. He had a duty to provide care for this patient. And that care would have been an endoscopy. We shouldn't have to go down that route because that wasn't the issue in the trial court, but the expert said he should have performed an endoscopy or had some.
Is this case any different than any other medical situation where a doctor is being informed remotely? Say it's a doctor on call covering for another doctor, being informed by a nurse, by whoever it is, of certain signs, symptoms, findings, and failing to order something and not then being called to account. How is this any different?
That's our position, that a treating doctor, whether the treating doctor is bedside or remote, or as in the hypothetical in the case I cited by telephone, when the doctor is given a set of symptoms, the doctor, and for his patient, the doctor has a duty to care for that patient. And in this case, the duty would have been to perform an endoscopy. It didn't matter if Dr. Yeager was bedside and listened to the patient's breathing by himself, or if a nurse told him or a resident told him. The duty is to respond to what you have been told. And he did not respond.
You're not suggesting, Mr. Rasek, that Dr. Yeager had to look behind or second guess the findings made by the resident. He could accept those, but your argument is even if you do accept those, further action was necessary.
That's exactly right. Whether Dr. Yeager saw the patient or someone else told him the patient's symptoms, Dr. Gerland said, and at this point it's uncontested, I'm sure it will be later, but it's uncontested, at least for purposes of this motion. When the attending physician, and that's Yeager, without contest, has information, that doctor's got to treat. It doesn't matter how that information got to the doctor. There's no case that I'm aware of, and certainly none cited here, that said because a doctor's input is filtered by somebody else, that that takes away that doctor's duty to care for his patient. And clearly, Tyrone Lewis was his patient.
Another question, at what stage did the summary judgment motion come in? Where were the parties in discovery?
To my knowledge, to my knowledge, and I'll have my opposing counsel may be better able to answer that question. They'd gotten to the point where, they just had gotten to the point with COVID where they had done some discovery and have not completed, to my knowledge, had not even completed discovery at this point.
Well, and so obviously you hadn't gotten to expert discovery, but you're saying that not even back discovery treating witnesses had been deposed?
I'm not, to my knowledge, not from what I'm aware of, from what I've seen. They deposed Dr. Yeager and they deposed Dr. Teal. To my knowledge, and I could be wrong, the other people have not been disposed. As the court's aware, there it's a complex case with other people involved in the care. Dr. Gerland has, for example, the expert presented by affidavit, but he has not been deposed yet.
Thank you.
Unless the court has further questions, obviously our request is that the summary judgment be reversed and the matter remanded. Thank you.
All right, I see none, so thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. I think we're all in agreement on two key facts here. One, Dr. Yeager did not see Mr. Lewis on August 29th, 2014. And two, this is not a negligent supervision case. And what I want to do is start with that second fact, because I think it ties into some of what's being argued here and trying to impose liability on Dr. Yeager. There's a case called Foster versus Inglewood Hospital Association. And the citation to that is 19 Illap 3rd, 1055. It's a case from the first district in 1974.
Counsel, now, before you, I'd like for you to just bookmark where you're at right now. Sure. And I apologize for interrupting, but you're setting up the framework of analysis with two points, but I think it presupposes that the only claim deviation from the standard of care, or the claim malpractice here by Dr. Yeager, is that he negligently directed the resident. From what Mr. Rasek just informed us, it's that he was provided with information, facts by the resident, which then imposed on his, he then failed to do something. He had an active role in the patient's care, albeit he did not see the patient, but that's not necessary in all medical circumstances to be considered a treating physician. He was provided with information, had the opportunity to direct the care, and failed to do something that Mr. Rasek's client is saying is a deviation from the standard of care. So before you continue with your discussion about negligent supervision, can you just respond to that? Why isn't this simply a case of a physician being provided with medical information, and he is part of the treatment team in this regard? He fails to do something as alleged by the plaintiff. How is that not active negligence?
Well, Your Honor, we did move for summary judgment, and I would submit that if you looked at the Dr. Gerland affidavit, he doesn't address those issues. There's no, it's conclusory, his statements. There's no facts or background about why Dr. Yeager should have taken this action or that action based on the symptoms that were presented or the information that was presented to him.
Ms. Barron, that was not your theory below. You did not attack those issues. And had they been attacked, maybe the affidavit would have been amended. But your theory below was simply, I didn't have my hands on this. I don't have responsibility.
But it relates to the issue of proximate cause. And you raised the issue earlier of we don't know what would have happened to Mr. Lewis.
We may have raised it, but you didn't. Well, and below the, I mean, the affidavit, you're right. It's very sketchy and conclusory, but it wasn't responding to that point either.
But it does try to raise duty and proximate cause and those issues which are essential to a medical malpractice case. And it doesn't get there. It's conclusory in that fact. We move kind of on the proximate cause issue of nothing that Dr. Lewis did or did not do. He didn't see the patient on August 29th, 2014 led to this patient's injuries. And there's nothing in this affidavit that said, hey, if Dr. Lewis had done X, the outcome would have been different. There's no...
I think that's a shift from what you argued below. What you argued below was, hey, I was just supervising. I didn't have any role. But now you want to drill down into the specifics of the care and say, well, but we need to know if you'd have done X, Y, and Z, that it would have made a difference. And that really was not the theory below.
But I think part of it, Your Honor, is what does negligent supervision mean? And this whole theory of
it's control, not an issue here. I think that's when we know that it's not an issue here.
Right. But it requires an analysis of, we went on summary judgment on negligent supervision. What does that mean? All these allegations regarding control, managing the resident, taking the information.
You won, but it was conceded. So, I mean, that's not a big victory. What you won on was the argument that your client did not have a role in the patient's care on the evening in question. Isn't that really how you won?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. The court also found there were no allegations regarding this concept of negligent supervision that were raised in the complaint.
Right, since that was given away, that was conceded. All over the record below, all over the record here. We don't need to go down that way, right?
Right. But my point too is you have to evaluate what is a negligent supervision claim in this context. And our position.
Why do we have to?
Because I think it gets rid of the rest of these arguments that he had a duty to do X, Y, and Z. And the corollary to that, or what's associated with that, is, okay, let's assume that's true. The Dr. Gerland affidavit doesn't address those matters. So you don't have issues or anything in there relating to proximate cause. It's not based on just a conclusion. We don't know what it is about the presentation of Mr. Lewis on August 29th, 2014, which required Dr. Yeager to act. What is it? There's nothing in the Gerland affidavit to that effect. And if you look at the Gerland affidavit,
Can you tell us where in the record that was the issue raised?
Well, I believe it was part of our summary judgment. In moving, I will agree that our motion was very simple, but I think the court took it a step farther and evaluated these issues. And if you look
at... Is that appropriate?
Well, I think that's a great question, Your Honor, but I think a trial court can rule upon what's in front of him at the time, and that's what he found.
Do you concede there was a physician-patient relationship with Dr. Yeager?
I do not, because... I think looking at that Thiel case that Mr. Rathsack had cited earlier is actually very helpful in this circumstance. In that case, the doctor performed a bronchoscopy and he was the second doctor to perform a surgical procedure on the patient. His partner had previously performed one. The doctor performed the bronchoscopy, saw the patient in follow-up and discharged the patient knowing a complication could arise. The patient subsequently returned to the ER. The doctor was called. The doctor did not see the patient at that time, and he moved for summary judgment. But essential to the court's opinion in that case is that the doctor maintained a relationship with the patient until the chance for post-procedure complications had passed. That's specifically stated in that opinion. And here, there's not that relationship. There's not that continuing relationship. Dr. Yeager saw Mr. Lewis once in the hospital, but Mr. Lewis was never said, go back to that clinic and follow up with Dr. Yeager. Dr. Yeager was not his primary providing physician in that clinic setting.
If Dr. Yeager is not an integral part of the patient's care, then what is the point of the resident reporting to Dr. Yeager?
It's a teaching facility, Your Honor.
That's it? It's just strictly for the education of the resident and not for the care of the patient?
Well, in part, Dr. Yeager admitted if this patient had presented with X symptom or Y symptom or something more complex, he would have seen the patient.
Doesn't that tell it all? Doesn't that tell us that Yeager knew that he had an obligation, if the facts warranted, to personally become involved in this patient's care? And the issue between the parties is whether those facts existed. Isn't that really the case?
Correct, but where are those facts? That's I would say they haven't been submitted.
That's not your theory. Your theory was there's no facts. There could be no fact that would bring him involved because he's just a supervisor.
But I'm also required to respond to my opponent's arguments, which is what I've done here and pointed that out when they say, oh, there is this direct theory of some type of liability. And that's why I mentioned earlier, you really have to look at what negligent supervision means and what it doesn't mean, because this whole thing of ultimate responsibility, the court kicked that out the window. That's a theory of vicarious liability that doesn't come into play here.
I tend to agree with you, but I'm still trying to understand how the attending physician has no duty to the patient.
And it's based on the circumstances of each case. And here, I mean, there's nothing like that Thiel relationship. There's nothing, this case is more similar to the Reynolds case, which I believe is where the physician was called, who was outside of the hospital and gave some advice. And the court found that summary judgment was appropriate in that circumstance.
But Dr. Yeager, if he had decided that the right thing to do here would have been to either admit the patient, perform the scope procedure, or get a consult, if he thought that was the right thing to do, it would have happened.
Correct, but there's no fact supporting that was the right thing to do.
You're sliding away from the point. What that tells us is he had a decision-making role in this case. You may question whether the decision should have been made in that way, but he had a decision-making role.
Counsel, ultimate responsibility, although it sounds like it's not an issue, my position would be, at least my analysis of this would be, it only goes to point out it's his place or his position in the process, not so much negligent supervision as simply that he's a cog in this wheel. And that ultimate responsibility just means, as Justice Doherty just pointed out, but for his decision, things are going to happen one way or another. And that decision is going to ultimately be his. The supervision of a third-year resident may be significantly less than it is for the first-year resident, like the evidence was presented, but it's still is some process that requires him to either sign off on or disagree with or do something as part of this process. How does that not make him a necessary part of the medical decision-making of Mr. Lewis's care?
Well, I go back to those are the allegations of the vicarious liability, which the courts rejected. If you look at that case in Foster, that was a little different facts. It was a surgeon who was in the operating room with a nurse who improperly administered the anesthesia. And that case talks about how there needs to be physician's direct control or supervision. So all those arguments are out. So I think at most what you're left with is this, okay, he had some, I guess we could call it an independent duty, but he still has to allege that and come forward with facts supporting that to create a genuine issue of material fact.
Well, are you saying that they didn't plead it properly?
Well, I think if you look at the complaint, it's very, it pretty much tracks the allegations of the Gerland affidavit. And that's one of the reasons we moved for summary judgment is let's flesh out what this complaint means. And we won. So
isn't that the role of a motion to dismiss?
I don't think a party is required to file a motion to dismiss. As you know, the summary judgment statute provides that you can move for summary judgment at any time. And if the opposing party believes that more discovery needs to be done, there's a whole process in Illinois Supreme Court Rule 191B to to discuss what submitting an affidavit saying we need more time. And that was not done here.
Well, it's a very fundamental difference between a motion to dismiss and a summary judgment motion. The motion to dismiss addresses a pleading deficiency. The motion for summary judgment addresses an evidentiary deficiency here. So you're talking about pleading issues. You picked the tool here, a summary judgment motion. Justice Doherty, you know, previously talked about how you confined your argument to something particular. You also indicated the trial court maybe went beyond that and started getting into the proximate cause, cause in fact. What are we to do here? I mean, we're addressing the battlefield as it lays before us.
Well, I think your review is de novo, so you can affirm on any basis, even one that was not necessarily considered below. So it's like you're taking a new look at the summary judgment. And we would ask that this decision be affirmed for the reasons I've stated today and that what we say in our appellate court brief. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ratzak, rebuttal.
Just very brief. The bottom line here is that this resident was a messenger, took information back to a doctor who had to be the attending because the resident reports to the attending, and that's the only person she reported to. And according to our expert witness, Dr. Yeager, when he got that information from the messenger, made the wrong decision. The patient needed a different kind of care. That was the only issue in the summary judgment motion was simply, what was Dr. Yeager's role in the care? Was he a caregiver or not a caregiver? Was he an attending or not? The other issues are going to be presumably handled when the case gets remanded and people start getting into detailed discovery, and it may require further amendment to experts. I don't know, but that's not the issue for this court. Unless the court has further questions, I would simply just ask for a reversal.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I see no other questions. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.